It's great to have everybody here. Some of you know I had throat surgery a couple weeks ago and a couple years ago as well, so I will try to be as loud as I can without losing my voice. They gave me a microphone that has a whopping 1 foot cord on it. And then they're demanding that I'm tethered so the people who aren't here can hear it later. And so I'm in my grumpy trance. Because there's no such thing as doing hypnosis to somebody or hypnotizing somebody. The reason why is we are always in a state of trance. We are always in a state of the ability to tap into any resource, whether it's grumpiness for self-protection or actually grumpiness because I'm a control freak, or whether it's happiness and joy, or whether it's change or productivity. So my idea of hypnosis is not that I'm doing hypnosis to somebody. Now, I do remember the very first time I hypnotized somebody. I remember when I hypnotized my first client, I guess. I was in graduate school. I was really lucky. I accidentally learned hypnosis. I was working on my master's degree in counseling, and I had to do a 300-hour practicum in order to graduate and get my degree. And I went to a couple of places and said, hey, I need a 300-hour practicum. Can it help me out? And they all said no. And there was a grumpy old psychologist in Tulsa who said, yeah, I'll use you. And I said, great, because I'm up against a wire, and I have to have my 300 hours in. And so I went to my first counseling session with him. He was a psychologist. And he hypnotized the client. And I had never seen that before. I didn't know what hypnosis was. And I said, do you do that with all your clients? And he said, well, yes. And I said, who are you? He was a wizard or something. And he explained to me that he was a hypnotist. That he was trained by a guy named Dr. Milton Erickson, and that he was a member of a group called ASH, the American Society of Clinical Hypnotists, and that he was going to be training me in hypnosis if I was going to be working in his office with his clients. So it was probably a week or two later, and he was probably tired or hungover or something like that. And he said, you do this one. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm not really sure if I can actually hypnotize somebody. And I just did exactly what Dean did, and it worked. Now, that was my first client in a clinical session. They closed their eyes. They followed my directions. We explored their ideas, and 30 or 40 minutes later, however long the session was, they opened their eyes and they were happy. And I thought to myself, this is awesome. And I also remember thinking to myself as I drove my 1973 Pontiac Grand Am home. I had painted on the back of it the shark in college because, you know, it was that white car. It looked like a shark with a big grill on the front. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, I hypnotized somebody just like the comic books. Now, fast forward years later, I've been doing hypnosis with a lot of different clients in a lot of different treatment settings, and now I had learned stage hypnosis. Actually, I hadn't really learned stage hypnosis. I knew enough about hypnosis to know that if I watched some stage hypnosis shows, I could probably do one myself. And so I booked my first gig. And when I booked my first gig, at Stooges Bar and Grill in Andover, Kansas. Anyone ever been in Andover, Kansas? There you go. I didn't think so. If you ever went, you would remember it. So I booked my first gig there, and I remember I felt like I was in over my head, and I had 10 or 12 people up on the stage, and I did my whole induction this way. Because I didn't want to have to look at them. Because this bar had agreed to pay me $1,000 and give me $5 for everybody who bought a ticket. That was going to be like $1,700. Because when there's something other than a country western band in Andover, Kansas, everybody shows up. And I remember I got done with the induction, and I gave that hypnotic suggestion. And from this point forward, if I should tap you on the forehead, if I should say the word sleep, if I shake your hand, you'll instantly return back to this position that you're in now, deeply relaxed and following every one of my suggestions. And I turned around, and they were all out. I was like, holy shit, this stuff works. Then I remembered what Dean had told me. If you do stage hypnosis, you have crossed into the dark side. So, I was having a lot of fun on stage, but I was also really worried because it meant I was actually trading all my old friends for a bunch of new friends. Group hug. And I've been happy ever since. Because hypnosis doesn't belong just in one place, in an office, or on a stage. And hypnosis isn't something we do to somebody. It is something we all experience together, every one of us. Whether we're on a stage, in a show, in an audience, in an office, as a hypnotist, driving your car, being a parent, being in love, or traveling, or any of the tasks of the day that we do, whether they're mundane or whether they're really important. I've had the opportunity to travel all over the world. I love to travel. It's actually my favorite thing to do. So last year I was in 17 different countries. And every time I got off a plane in a new country, I was in trance. Hypnosis is not something we do to somebody. It's something really that we share with somebody. So one of my early teachers, his name was Bob Belay, Florida State University, another contemporary of Milton Erickson's. And I trained with him in Germany in the early 2000s, and Bob never titled his workshops, Bob Teaches Hypnosis. He actually titled his workshop, catch this, Advanced Accurate Empathy. So I was a counselor getting my continuing education hours, and I signed up for a class titled Advanced Accurate Empathy. Okay. Now, there are a lot of people who have talked about empathy and counseling. Gerard Egan is one of those people. I thought to myself, this will probably be in the tradition of Gerard Egan, who's a psychologist and a Roman Catholic priest and has written a book called The Skilled Helper. It's actually fantastic that everybody should buy. And I walked into Bob Belay's class in Germany, and we were all ready for a class. Do I have a chair anywhere? Here's exactly what Bob did. He had a chair up here, and he kept just spinning the chair as he did his introduction. Two. You're the counter. One more. Yeah. So Bob was doing this. And he was just talking to us. And as Bob was talking to us, and as he was just sort of spinning the chair, I noticed that as I looked around the room, the other 25 or 30 therapists who were there, some of their hands started to rise in the air. And I thought to myself, another Ericksonian. And that's exactly where I was. I was in a hypnosis training class. But I was always struck, not by what Bob taught in the class. It was a basic class in Ericksonian hypnosis. It was a great class, I'm sure. Not a lot that I really particularly remember since I've been doing a lot of hypnosis at that point. But I will never forget the title, Advanced Accurate Empathy. He never used the word hypnosis. He always used the word empathy. He derived that from some of the writings of Ernest Rossi. And Ernest Rossi, as you know, was a contemporary of Milton Erickson's who wrote many books with Milton Erickson. And you probably have read some of Ernest Rossi's books. If you haven't, my favorite book by Ernest Rossi is The Psychobiology of Immune System Response. And every hypnotist should buy that book. The Psychobiology of Immune System Response. If you don't have it, go buy it. If you wonder, how does hypnosis work to treat HIV-positive individuals, cancer patients, to help people recover faster, to heal better, and to significantly use hypnosis to improve the lives of individuals who are suffering, you will benefit from the book, Psychobiology of Immune System Response by Ernest Rossi. And Ernest Rossi described to Bob Belay hypnosis this way. He called it belly button to belly button communication. This is, of course, a metaphor for an exchange of nutrients and life, which is where Bob came up with the idea of advanced accurate empathy. And so I had the opportunity to learn from these folks that I really wasn't hypnotizing anyone. That I was actually being allowed the opportunity to be in their space so that I could share that space with them and create something magnificent. Now, I recognized that I had a problem. Because back in the early 2000s, I wasn't feeling so magnificent. And how can I be in somebody's space and help them to be magnificent if I myself wasn't magnificent? By the way, I'm really grateful that we don't have to be perfect in order to help other people. But there's a line from the Alcoholics Anonymous tradition I really like, and that is, we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And the word progress is really important. We have a goal and we're moving forward in each and every one of our actions each and every day. What that tells me is that in order to be a good hypnotist, to share that space with gratitude, it's important for me to be hypnotic. Not to just do hypnosis, but to, in my own life, live the principles that I am sharing with my clients. And so the first step in 24-hour trance is to be hypnotic yourself. To use the discipline of hypnosis that we know can benefit other people experientially in our own lives. My clients ask me, they say, well, I'm here, Richard, to quit smoking or lose weight or find lost objects or stop chasing cars or whatever it is that they came to my office for. And they have this question for me. Almost all my clients have this question because I ask them, you know, in the pre-talk, I say, do you have any questions for me? It's 2.5. And they almost all say the same question. Well, have you ever used hypnosis in your own life? I love that question. And the answer is yes, for the obvious reasons. In the early 2000s, I was paralyzed by fear. I was doing hypnosis with clients. I was helping them to recover from drug addiction. I was working as a substance abuse counselor primarily. I was working with eating disordered individuals. I was dealing with obsessive compulsive personality traits. But I hadn't been working with fears and phobias because in 2001, Richard would not get on an airplane. Richard would not drive a car down Highway 75 in Dallas, Texas, because it was too much traffic, and Richard would not get on an elevator. I actually had a job offer as a therapist at a facility that was a great job. And I went to go talk to the executive director, but because my background is in criminal justice, it was a secure building, and I got there to meet with the executive director, and it required that I take the elevator to the third floor. And I wouldn't do it. I just told the receptionist, I said, you know what, tell him I got tied up, I have somewhere to go. And I walked away from that job because I had to take an elevator to get to the third floor. By the way, I'm executive platinum on American Airlines. I flew 172,000 miles last year. And when I see the airplanes flying overhead in my neighborhood now, I'm really upset that I'm not on one of those airplanes. How did I do that? I learned to use hypnosis to overcome my own fear. I did it in a challenging way. I practiced and practiced what I had my clients practice, and I got on that airplane in Dallas and I flew to Zurich. And the nice thing about a flight to Zurich to overcome your fear of flying is there's no way home unless you're successful. So it obviously worked, and I've been flying, you know, again ever since then. I'll even take the elevator at the Orleans, and I know that's high risk. So when clients ask me, have you used hypnosis in your own life, I can give them concrete examples of how I have used hypnosis in my own life with very specific things. But I can also share with them that each and every day I use self-hypnosis in one way or another to better and improve my own life. And I don't do this so that I can achieve Maslow's hierarchy and self-actualization and be a guru somewhere. I do it simply so that I can share with other people more effectively the gift of hypnosis. So the first question for you is, are you practicing what it is that you're sharing with clients? Because it becomes extremely easy to do hypnosis when we are doing hypnosis in our own lives. We should be our own best client. In fact, when you are your own best client, you'll find that you don't hypnotize people anymore. What you do is you enter into rapport with them, you share an experience with them, and both of you emerge better, and catch this, they pay you for it. So sometimes hypnotists ask me the question, do you ever go into trance with your clients when you're doing a hypnosis session? And my answer to that is, if I'm doing it correctly, I should always be sharing a trance with my clients. But my goal with my clients is not when the session is over, they reemerge from trance. My goal is that when I've worked with them successfully, that they have used the ability to tap into a resource state that we all identify as a formal trance process, but I give them this post-hypnotic suggestion. By the way, all post-hypnotic suggestions come from my client. And I know that my clients want this post-hypnotic suggestion because they paid me. They made an appointment with me. And the post-hypnotic suggestion I give them is that when you leave my office, when you step over the threshold of the door, when you enter the elevator, when you ride down to the bottom, when you walk out the front door of the building and leave those glass doors and step into the parking lot, you're entering into a new chapter of life. One where at any time, in any place, whether it's a day from now, a week from now, a month from now, a year from now, or 10 years from now, you can take and use what we've learned in this session at any moment in any place to accomplish that which is most important to you, or some variation of that type of post-hypnotic suggestion. Because in every session that I do with my clients, I want my clients to come back from, to go back to their real world with something that's of value to them from the session so that they cannot just be hypnotized in my office, but be hypnotic. In fact, my goal, I'm really good at marketing. Anyone notice that, by the way? And sometimes we're like, wow, Richard, how are you so good at marketing? If I type hypnosis into Google, I get you. If I go to Amazon and try to buy a hypnosis book, I get you. If I go to YouTube and try to find anything out about hypnosis, I get you. How did that happen? I'm actually really good at marketing. The reason why I'm really good at marketing, and I've taken the time to learn, by the way. How do you get good at marketing? You stop buying hypnosis books and you start buying business books. One, for example, is $1 million consulting. The idea here is get rid of the bottom 20% of your clients every year and replace them with a new, better 20% of your clients. Sometimes hypnotists say to me, why are your fees twice as much as every other hypnotist? Well, because I followed the advice in that business book, because I don't have an MBA. My favorite marketing book right now, 80-20 Marketing by Perry Marshall. It's the best book out there. It'll transform your practice. By the way, I don't know Perry Marshall. He doesn't give me a cut for recommending it. 80-20 Marketing by Perry Marshall. It's actually on my phone, the audio version of it. And I just drive around and listen to it over and over and over again because there's always something I glean from it. But the reason why I'm good at marketing is because my goal is to get rid of my clients. I have to be good at marketing because if I'm doing my job correctly, my clients don't come back anymore. So my cousin, actually he's my cousin-in-law. Is that such a thing? He's married to my cousin. He's also a professional counselor. Okay, and we were at Thanksgiving dinner at my aunt's house many years ago, and we were eating, you know, turkey and stuffing and whatever it is people eat for Thanksgiving, and his cell phone rang, and he answered it, and I thought my aunt was going to freaking lose it, and so he, excuse me, and he sneaks out in the middle of Thanksgiving dinner, and he's in the other room talking to whoever it was on the phone, and he came back, of course, by the time we were all done eating, and his mother-in-law, my aunt, was scowling at him. He said, I had to take that call. That was a patient of mine. And he said, you know, I'm new in private practice. I'm trying to build my practice. And I need to meet the needs of my clients so that they can, you know, keep coming back because, you know, if I have 20 slots a week and if I fill those slots and they keep coming back, then I'll have a thriving private practice. I didn't say anything because it was a family dinner. I have full faith that he'll never hear this recording. But my thought at the time was, wow, my job isn't to retain my clients. My job is to get rid of, my goal is to get rid of my clients. And the way I get rid of my clients, which is why you have to be good at marketing, because you have to replace the old clients with new clients. Now, you get a significant portion of those from referrals, but we want to get rid of our clients, and we get rid of our clients by helping them to be hypnotic. So when they step over that threshold of the door, they don't have to come back for more hypnosis from me in order to be okay. They have, in fact, become hypnotic themselves. I view myself and my hypnosis sessions really, in many ways, as a teacher of hypnosis, much like a yoga teacher or some other type of spiritual teacher might be, or a personal fitness trainer. I mean, that's really the role that I see myself in, because my goal is to help people not to be hypnotized, but to be hypnotic. So let's talk about some ways to be hypnotic. Obviously, in our own lives, we can practice the principles that we all know. We can do self-hypnosis, etc. Now, probably everybody in this room has read a Tony Robbins book or has, at one level or another, you know, watched a Tony Robbins video, or maybe some of you have actually gone on a Tony Robbins firework. I know Chihira has. If you're going to Fiji, or you've been to Fiji? Going to Fiji. So there you go, this year. So usually at any hypnosis convention, there's lots of Tony Robbins fans, and Tony Robbins, of course, is known for his six human needs. Let's take a look at these six human needs, and let's put it in context of being hypnotic. So the first of Tony Robbins' six human needs is the need for certainty. I was talking about PTSD yesterday, and I used the phrase homeostasis and equilibrium. Okay? But Tony Robbins uses that word stability. We really don't like it when things are not consistent with our expectations. We are creatures of habit. Most of the time, you do almost always the same thing each and every day, don't you? In fact, you set your alarm for 7 o'clock in the morning, but you get up automatically at 6:50 right before it goes off, don't you? Then you wake up and you go downstairs. They make a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or a cup of orange juice, whatever it is that you drink in the morning, and you make yourself a bagel or an English muffin or some rice soup or whatever it is that you eat in the morning for breakfast, right? And most of the time you actually eat the same thing, don't you? Most of the time. I mean, you might throw in some variety every now and then. Today I'll have toast, but by tomorrow you're back to English muffins and cream cheese. You leave the house to do whatever it is that you do in the morning, whether it's take a kid to school or whether it's go to an office or whether it's to do a job different than hypnosis or whatever it is that you do. And you do that almost every day. You come home, you go to a bed about the same time after really doing about the same things. Stability. Certainty. We like that a lot. So I've gotten in the habit many years ago of being much better at money than I was many years ago. Because I learned it's just a lot better to live life with stability. And so my bills are paid far in advance. And I put a certain amount of money to cover all of my expenses in my checking account that covers my expenses every month. But I actually do that for the next month. So all those autographs are always there. I never have to worry about it. Certainty. We love that. Homeostasis. Equilibrium. We love that. When our clients come to us, one of their big needs is that they are living really an unstable life. And they're living an unstable life because of their own choices. If you eat unhealthy foods and you get up to 450 pounds and you don't have any physical activity, there's a lot of uncertainty about what you can and cannot do and whether you'll live or not live. So it's a horrible way to live. Smokers, they don't have it. By the way, when I do hypnosis for smoking cessation, nobody's 23 makes an appointment. My clients are 58 years old. Why? Because at 23, you can smoke a pack of cigarettes a day and everything is stable. When you're 58 and the doctor tells you you have COPD and you're wondering if you have to have stents put in your heart, you make an appointment to see a hypnotist because now things are not certain. You love your grandchildren and you want to spend time with them, but because you're smoking, you wonder if you're going to see their 10th birthday or not. So these things drive our clients' needs. And the approach to hypnosis that we take is one to help them to achieve homeostasis, equilibrium, or certainty. Now, the next thing Tony Robbins identifies is kind of interesting. It's actually the exact opposite of that. One of our human needs is variety. The reason people love hypnothoughts is not because it's awesome. I know, this is shocking, isn't it? It's not because there are great speakers teaching all kinds of really cool things and magnificent classes here and there. In fact, most of you, to be honest, you got a couple of tidbits of wisdom and information that you'll probably use somewhere, but most of you will forget almost every class that you went to, including this one. You came to hypnosis for our second human need, variety. Remember how you were doing the same thing every day, getting up at the same time every morning and driving your car to the same place and doing the same things? After a while, you say, you know what, I need to mix it up and go to Vegas for 4 or 5 days. And you can do that tax deductible by coming to a hypnosis conference. How many of you, by round of applause, have had more fun than the quantity of learning you've had? It's variety that drives this. Richard was in 17 countries last year. Richard has been in 0 countries this year. Ooh. Guess what I'm ready to do? Have passport, well travel. Excited. The opportunity to get out. I had a couple surgeries this year, some things slowed me down. Now that I'm out of the clear, look, my voice has worked for the entire weekend. We're almost done with the weekend. I can still talk. Now, I'm not the loudest guy here, but I can still talk. And I'm not dying. That's a big plus. Because at last year's conference, I was kind of worried about dying. So that's definitely not on the table anymore. So that's actually pretty cool. So, yeah. So have passport, world travel. I'm calling my sister. I'm like, hey, can I come visit you in Prague? She lives in Prague. You know, I'm talking to Carl Smith. I'm like, hey, why don't you bring me to Hypno Academy in London? I'd love to talk for a couple days. Hey, you can have all the money. I just need to get out of here. All right. We have a need for variety. We have a need to mix it up a little bit. Trance is a great way to have variety. What have I been doing in my self-hypnosis this year? I've been traveling. I was really lucky. So I had my surgery about 6-7 weeks ago. And I love my ENT, my ear, nose, throat doctor. He's a great guy. He's totally awesome and very, very helpful. So I'm getting ready to go into the surgery. And the anesthesiologist, my best friend, in fact, I talked with my buddy who's the anesthesiologist yesterday, if you were in my class yesterday. So I asked my ENT, I said, hey, my best friend's an anesthesiologist, and I don't have to pay him. So can I have him do the anesthesiology? And he said, no. He said, I only work with one anesthesiologist because I've been working with her for years, so that's your anesthesiologist. So I was a little bummed about this. So the anesthesiologist comes in, and she starts to talk beforehand and give me some information. And she seems like she's a cool anesthesiologist, but she's not my best friend. And my wife, where is she? She's somewhere here. Yeah, voila, Paul. She doesn't speak a whole lot of English. And so I got up to use the restroom, but my, you know, the hospital robe where the back is open. So I told my wife in Chinese, I said, hey, I'm going to go use the restroom, but my ass is hanging out. And the anesthesiologist said, in Chinese, you speak Chinese? And I said, yes. And so then, you know, she realized that we all spoke Chinese. So she started talking to her, started talking to me. So when she's doing the anesthesia, she's doing it in Chinese. You know, anesthesiologists all do their own induction. She's like, I want you to imagine you're in a beautiful place in China right now. Where is your favorite place? What does it look like? Where is it? Blah, 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 blah. Imagine this now. She's doing a hypnotic induction, and she's counting backwards in Chinese. And it was so awesome. I was so grateful at that moment that my best friend was not doing the anesthesia. Because he would have just said, shut the hell up, stop talking, suck it up, and in a few minutes, you'll be awake. He's my guy friend. So when I emerged from anesthesia, she was there, and she greeted me in Chinese, and she greeted me, catch this, with the conclusion of my journey. And it was pretty cool because I wasn't really confident in my Chinese, but under anesthesia, apparently I'm really good at it. So I was having this whole conversation with her, which means I finally embedded it into my subconscious mind. So she left, and then I sort of got awake from the grogginess, and the Filipino nurses were there, and I looked at them, I said, was I talking to you in Chinese? And they said, no, you were talking to the doctor, and he wouldn't shut up. Right. But my self-hypnosis has been about variety. It's been taking me to some wonderful places. I'm actually grateful that this year I have been tethered. This is really a metaphor for the last year. And have been unable to travel because it's caused me to practice self-hypnosis new ways. And I've learned something. That I can develop patience. So our third human need is significance. Now, some of you remember a book by Robert McGee titled The Search for Significance. We all want to feel significant. So it's really kind of odd. I just remember that this happened. So this morning, I took a shower. I got dressed. I had, you know, I picked out some poorly matched clothes, as I typically do. And I was waiting for my wife to finish getting ready. And I looked over at my bookshelf, and there is an award that IMDHA gave me in May or whatever. So they gave me some Hypnotist Lifetime Achievement Award. It's a clock. It's kind of probably costs like $15 at the trophy store. And it's not fancy. There's not a battery in it. It doesn't actually tell me what the time is. But it says Richard Nongard Lifetime Achievement Award Hypnosis, IMDHA 2017. And what it's sitting next to is interesting. It's sitting on a shelf next to a trophy of, you know, kind of looks like a Rolls Royce hood ornament that says Robert I. Tenney, you know, 1952 or whatever. Now, Robert I. Tenney is my grandfather, Bubba. And so this trophy I got and this trophy he got are sitting there. What's interesting is this. My grandparents traveled the world. My grandparents, you know, were on, you know, Boeing 707s, traveling to places where they probably should have crashed in the 1940s and 50s and 30s and 70s and 80s. And my grandparents lived in a... Uh-oh. We'll give it one more chance. My grandparents lived in a huge house when I was growing up. It was the coolest place in the world because you could hide, right? You could play hide and seek, and there were all kinds of cool things just about everywhere in this house. And when they finally retired, they downsized, and they moved to Sun City, Arizona, into a much smaller house, probably about 2,000 square feet because they still needed the space for, you know, grandkids and kids when they came to visit, a couple bedrooms, et cetera. And then when they moved from there, when they were in their 90s, they moved to a retirement center, and they moved into a two-bedroom apartment. It was probably about 1,500 square feet. And they had a guest room for people who did come to visit them, and they had their room and their kitchen. They had their dining area, and they had their living room. And their house kept getting smaller and smaller. As they got to their mid-90s, they had broken hips and those types of things, and they had moved at that retirement center from the big apartment they had down to a two-room suite in SNF, in skilled nursing, short-stay living, whatever else. And it was a two-room, so it was probably about 900 square feet. And so every time they moved, they had to get rid of stuff, okay? And when my grandfather died at 98 years old, by the way, he died on a Sunday. He was still working the Friday beforehand. And the entire weekend that he was dying, he was pissed off because he still had shit he needed to get done, and he knew it was over. He loved working. He was in perfect health until the very, very end. And as the doctor said to him, if I could do surgery and give you a new heart at 98, you'd probably go to 198. Yeah. So when my grandfather died, though, he was in a 400-square-foot room. And this trophy was in that room. And it occurred to me, you accumulate everything from your life. You get smaller and smaller. And my question is, what makes it to that last room? What is most important to you? And I don't know what my grandfather got this trophy for. It simply says his name and has this big image on it. It's made of pop metal from a trophy shop. It's not expensive. It's not made from gold. It's not an Oscar. On eBay, it would probably bring $3 as some sort of curiosity or antique of some type. But what did it represent? It represented significance. He was a brewmaster. He was president of the American Brewmasters Association. So if you like beer, you can thank Bubba. More specifically, if you like wine coolers, because in the 1940s, he figured out how to take malt liquor and make it delicious. Because if you don't make it delicious and turn it into a wine cooler, it sucks. And he ended up selling that to Seagram's. And so next time you have a wine cooler, you thank Bubba. So he was a brewmaster. So this award is for something as a brewmaster. You know, some kind of award. Some probably like the hypno thoughts of brewmastery, right? Gave him a trophy. Significance. Here's the question for you. What are you doing to be significant today? Not to get accolades from your peers. They're just going to give you a clock that doesn't work or a cheap trophy from the trophy store down the street. But it is the recognition that we have done something noteworthy. How do you do that? In hypnosis. One of my favorite processes in hypnosis is values clarification. A Buddhist concept, the Eightfold Path, values clarification. What is it that's most important to you? That's what gives you significance. I get a tremendous amount of significance from my relationship with my kids. I just talked to my son yesterday. He's talking to me about his career path in the military. He's infantry. He's moving back to Fort Polk with his wife and kids. He's doing great. He's up for a promotion, and things are going really well for him, and he's an awesome kid. My daughter, she's 24. She was trying to get into the Olympics, so she started college late. She didn't start till she was 20, so she graduated this year with a speech language pathology degree. Some of you know Alex from my hypnosis videos. He's 21. He graduates this year with a combined master's bachelor's degree in economics, and he'll probably get a job at the Fed. And if we have any money next year, it'll probably be because he let us. So my kids are doing some awesome stuff. Now, my father committed suicide and died from his drug addiction. I never had a dad. I didn't know how to be a dad. And I remember when Ricky was born, he wasn't planned. You know, kids just sort of show up. People are like, I can't tell you that story. Forgot this is a polite crowd. So kids just kind of show up, right? And so I remember I was like, holy shit, I have a son. So I went over to my buddy Richard. He had five daughters, by the way. His wife had died in childbirth with the last kid, and he was a single father raising his kids. And I remember I actually went to Richard. He was my boss. And I said, Richard, I have a kid now. You're old. You have five. What am I supposed to do? I don't know how to be a dad. And he taught me how to be a dad. And I'm really grateful because I have friends who are, you know, my age, I went to high school with and have worked with over the years, and their kids aren't as awesome as my kids. And I just feel really grateful. I feel really grateful, not because they turned out so well, because I had great mentors to teach me those things. And the reality is I get most of my significance from my kids. For me, that's the most important thing. My kids call me. Wow. In fact, my son called me like three times yesterday, the one who's in the infantry, because he was bummed that I didn't answer the phone the first time, and he just wanted to say hi to dad. That's pretty cool. He didn't call me every day three times, but, you know, once, twice a week. Pretty cool. My kids actually call me. Awesome. Significance. The next thing, love. William Glasser wrote a book in the 1960s titled Reality Therapy. It's another good book for any hypnotist to buy. And William Glasser said, our greatest need is to love other people and to receive love in return. C.S. Lewis did a series of lectures at Oxford on love. And almost all of us are familiar with Eros love. That's our sensual sexual love. We're familiar with agape love, the love of God. We're familiar with philia love. That's our love of friendship. Those are the three Greek words for love that most of us are familiar with in Western culture, but the reality is there's a fourth Greek word for love, and that is storge love. And that is simply the affinity we have from one person towards another because they are also a creation of the divine and share this planet with us. And when we spend a lot of time focusing on Eros love and how to make love better. We spend a lot of time on philia love and cultivating friendships. And we spend a lot of time on agape love and, you know, accepting the love from, you know, our higher power or whatever towards us. But storge love is the most fascinating to me because it's never discussed in any literature. And it's simply that recognition that I share this space and this planet with other people. And that we are all a spark of the divine. Now, this is a concept that's really important because hypnosis works best when we don't feel ourselves better than or worse than our clients. When we view ourselves as sharing that space with them. Belly button to belly button communication. And storge love and cultivating storge love allows us to really build, I think, a better therapeutic process. So Tony Robbins then moves on, says, hey, there's a couple other things you got to talk about that are basic human needs. And one of these is growth or learning. What is it that you're learning today? Now, this is a great weekend for learning. Everybody's probably learning all kinds of cool stuff. By round of applause, how many people learned something? I've been actually teaching something pretty cool this weekend. I've been teaching a process for bilateral stimulation where you can, you know, EMDR, right? It works because of bilateral stimulation left brain. With your kinesthetic clients, people are like, how do you hypnotize the kinesthetic? They won't listen to me like the auditory. They won't visualize that happy, peaceful place like the, you know, visual person. Kinesthetic people, right? So a process for left-right integration, left-right hemispheres. I guarantee you people are going to be using this all week long. By the way, it's not necessarily profound. It's not something I developed. Something I've been teaching all weekend. I've been around for years and years and years. People learn cool stuff. We're able to take that back and use it with people. When we take it back and use it with people, not only did we learn, but they learn. And we can give somebody in hypnosis a gift that will last them the rest of their life. So that happened to me. I was 18. Everyone died or everyone moved. The only person left in my world was Stefan. Yes, Stefan. Stefan and I have been friends since we were 10 years old. Father was the pastor of our church, and we've been best friends ever since we were probably 9 or 10 years old. Stephanie's sister died, my dad died, everyone else died, or they moved away, or something horrible happened to them, and then Stephanie moved away, and I was all alone in Chicago, and it was cold, and I had a Pinto. A 1974 Pinto, orange and white with a gray primer door. Bob Johnson was the Campus Life Youth for Christ pastor, and I said, hey, Bob, things aren't going real well right now. And he said, you know what? You are far more screwed up than I can help you. You need to see a therapist. So he said, there's one in our office. I want you to come see this guy. This is my only appointment with a therapist as a patient. So I go in, and I sit down, and this blind guy comes out with his cane and his dog. And he said, are you Richard? And I said, yes. He leads me back to his office. I didn't know anything about counselors or therapists, but he has me close my eyes, create a visualization. He does an anchoring technique. Clearly, he had NLP training somewhere in the 1970s. I now recognize that. And he gave me an anchoring technique that was truly a useful way to access a resource state. I did not know that this was hypnosis. I did not know it was NLP at the time. I was just a kid who was over my head in stress and misery, and he helped me incredibly. And years later, when I could afford it, I actually bought the living room that I created in that scene. And even though mob furniture is no longer in style and my new furniture looks a lot better, I still use that same technique that he taught me in that one session today when the tough gets tough. So that therapist did an NLP hypnosis session with me. A blind therapist did creative visualization with me. And it stayed with me for, God, how old? 52 minus 18, whatever the math of that is, 35 years or more. Maybe that's 40 years. I don't know. It could be a long time. So when we learn, we can then transfer that learning. We can transform lives. And the sixth of Tony Robbins' needs is contribution. The Japanese word here is koken. The rest of the day, answer this question. What is your koken? What is your contribution? Because everything else to this point has been about self-help. But self-help is worthless unless we attach meaning to it, and we attach meaning to it when we have belly-button-to-belly-button communication, when we develop rapport with people and contribute to people. So what's your contribution? What's your koken? My contribution, I hope, is that I have made high-quality, low-cost hypnosis training available to everybody in the world, from YouTube to my own website, to conferences, and other things that I go to. In fact, I woke up this morning thinking to myself, I need to transcribe one of my videos into Chinese because there's 1.8 billion Chinese people who don't know about the things I teach in this video, and I think they will probably eat that up on Weibo or whatever it is they use. Not because I'm going to make money from it. Trust me, I guarantee they're going to pirate all my stuff. But if I translate some of it, more people will be hypnotic. And when the world is hypnotic, the world is a better place. So take in a deep breath. Breathe in and breathe out. Be present in this moment. Breathe in, breathe out. Let a smile come to your face. And enjoy not only doing hypnosis, but being hypnotic the rest of the day, the rest of the week when you return, the rest of the year, and the rest of your life. Thank you.